Welcome to all our furry and non-furry friend listeners to What the Bark, the Rightpaw podcast. We're back again with our good friend Genetic George. George, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Nathan.
And we've also got back again with another special guest. We're really excited to welcome Dr. Doug Black to the podcast. Doug's going to be talking to us all about microchips today and his incredible history with setting that up in Australia as well. But Doug, welcome to What the Bark.
Thanks, Nathan. And I'm very privileged to be talking to you two esteemed fellas.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug. You know, it's great to meet someone who's been in the industry for just as long as what I have.
I was going to say, yeah, you and George go back quite a way as well.
Oh, yes. Doug goes back even further. Let's get the age difference right.
Hey, hang on. At least I'm not wearing a white coat.
That's right. No, it's, you know, Nathan, you've been in that young bracket. Need to appreciate what Doug and I have been through and what we continue.
Oh, I don't put myself in the same class as you gentlemen at all.
Oh, that's good. That's a good start, respecting your elders, Nathan.
That's well it. And we have a really nice synergy with microchips. And when Doug talks, I'm sure we'll talk about the synergy it has with what we provide in the way of DNA testing. But yeah, lovely to have you on board, Doug. I apologise you weren't our first guest.
I'm shattered.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll probably have you back again anyway.
Absolutely. I think there's probably a couple of podcasts with Doug in the works at some point. We'll see. Well, let's get through the first one. He might not want to come back, so we'll see how we go. But Doug, for all our listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about who you are as well.
So I'm a vet, and I started off practice with two great mates, David Medill and Rick Waldock in Springvale. And I guess tying that up with the microchip story is that David and I specialised in birds. Don't hold that against me. But David was away at a bird vet conference, and he came back with this microchip and said, have a look at this, guys, you know. And this was designed really mainly for identifying, you know, valuable zoo animals and birds at that point. And
well, that was how George got his start as well, in bird sexing.
Oh, yeah, Nathan, that's another segment. Yes, I did get my – look at this similarity between Doug and George.
Oh,
yes,
hang on.
My first genetic start was in avian sexing and some disease assessment. So, wow, this is scary, Doug. It's almost like we were meant to be.
We're blood brothers.
Brothers. So, yeah, interesting.
Blood brothers.
You'll continue this story, but isn't it great, like, the lunacy of microchipping, which was, like, 20 years, people thought, what are you talking about, putting exactly something into an animal to identify it? You know, you guys are crazy. But continue on. Look where it's got to.
Yeah, so that's where the craziness was, that the three of us got together and thought, why are we using this for, you know, these sorts of animals? We should be just using this for dogs and cats. This is the answer to the one major issue that we kept facing all the time, that, you know, you get a dog or a cat brought into the clinic and it'd be either just a stray animal or an injured animal. And absolutely no way of finding the owner, apart from, you know, hoping the owner would call in or putting up ads in the local paper or in the milk bar or whatever. And
correct.
It just was a shock.
Or, you know, sometimes a collar, and it might have a phone number on there, but most of the times when a dog wanders or gets lost, slip the collar. So, yeah.
So we thought, this is it. So we thought we were it in a bit, and this was going to take off, and, you know, this is the answer to everything. And so we actually decided to buy some chips and get the reader. The reader was ridiculous. It was in this great big thing that hung around your shoulder, and you know, it's a bit like mobile phones in those early days, those great big bricks that we had. But and then we decided to, you know, talk to government and say, you know, this is the answer, please, you know, this is what we should be doing with all our dogs, to identify them. And about 6 months in, we finally had contact with positive contact from the government. The government said that they wanted to come out and meet us. And David and Rick and I were sitting in the clinic and thinking, we've made it. We've absolutely made it. And
And this was on no one's radar at this point. Like, no one was looking at this. It's just crazy to think there was a time like that.
Yes, well, it was the 1980s, so possibly before you were born, Nathan, maybe.
Oh, I can't comment on that.
Oh, sorry about that. So these government officials met us at the vet clinic, and they said, oh, it's about these microchips. And we said, yeah, you know, we've been sort of trying to get this accepted, you know, and what do you think? And they said, well, actually, we're here to tell you that the frequency of the microchips that you're using is designated for military and aeronautical use. Oh. And suddenly there was a stunned silence in the room. They go, what? What's that mean? And they said, you can't use it, boys. Yeah. What? So, you know, I don't know whether they had visions of poodles bringing down fighter planes,
right,
or whatever.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So we then had to rethink the whole thing, and we discovered that there was just, this was in the very early days of it, that there was one or two other companies that had a similar sort of, well, it was exactly the same product, but it was a different frequency, and it fitted the requirements that we could use for government. So we went out and bought Trovan chips, and Trovan is a German company that we've been with ever since. So that's you know, crikey, it's
that's one of the beauties of what you've liked, your Trovan and your quality. I remember I purchased one of your first Trovan readers, which was this huge dish on a, looked like a radar gun, you know, used to scan over it. And I'm going to do a little shout out here, because you mentioned one of your partners in crime, who is a very, very good friend of mine and someone that I spent a lot of time with, and that's Rick Walduck. And I'm sure he's going to tune in and listen. So I need to make sure I say hello. He has been someone who's been, I know you have too, Doug, with myself, but Rick has been someone who really made a huge push for microchipping, because don't forget, it was a voluntary program. It was never a compulsory program. People forget how difficult it was just to get someone to bring their dog and put in a form of positive ID, I call it, into their animal. A lot of them thought, you know, that a lot of questions were still asked and people didn't understand. It's just this, it's about, how big are they? About the size of a rice grain, is that right?
Yeah, they're only 12
minutes. Yeah, so coming to shows and trying to promote the benefits of it was a challenge. I mean, we accept it today, like most things, but, you know, 20 years ago, it was a voluntary program. It wasn't compulsory.
Absolutely. We ended up basically just buying readers and putting them out to council. So we sort of tried to do it as a, you know, kind of a mushroom top thing, and try and get the councils to sort of take on the reader. And then we just gave them the reader. So it certainly was expensive for a man.
Yes, they were. Yeah,
and then we'd go to the vets in those areas and say, hey, the councils are monitoring these stray dogs, so, you know, why don't you start chipping? And as you said, George, you know, Rick did the lion's share of that, because coincidentally at that same time, the other thing that happened in our veterinary careers was that the ostrich industry started, and we were approached by ostrich farmers, thinking, well, these guys are bird vets, so they know everything about ostriches, which was very far from the truth. But David said, oh no, I'm not doing that, I've had my fair share of farm work. So I ended up putting my hand up for that, and that ended up taking me all over Australia and overseas, because there was no one else silly enough to do it. But so I was off chasing ostriches. David was trying to run a busy small animal practice, and our sympathy was with him for that. Mm-hmm. And Rick then really was left doing a lot of the pioneering with the microchip thing. So it was definitely thanks to Rick's perseverance that all this happened. He had a lot of those early government meetings that we finally eventually got breakthroughs with.
I spent many times at country shows with the table right next to Rick and his team, and they would chip and I would swab, because, as I mentioned before, the synergy is that our protocols have what we call an approved collection method, which requires a positive ID. Because, you know, when I first started going to these shows, I'd get people bringing me their black Labrador and going, this is Charlie, and then another black Labrador and going, this is Mary, and they all look the same. So, you know, we needed a form to be able to identify these animals and ensures sample integrity, and the microchip is the only one. So the linking of a microchip number with a unique DNA profile number was perfect.
Absolutely. There's no, absolutely no point in doing any of the DNA analysis or even things like importing of animals and disease control, all of that. You know, you must have a positive ID of the animal before it's of any use whatsoever.
You know? So we had our table next to each other, and from, you know, discussion and Rick and, you know, the good old times when, you know, we could just banter Rick to his, I mean, he used to love a cigarette, and I'll mention it. There's no harm in that back in the day, in the days too, with the chat. And he had a lovely team, and it was just great days, you know. But then it all became, that was in the part when it was a voluntary program. It wasn't really compulsory. So it was building towards a compulsory program. So the question I've got is, who was the first state to make it compulsory?
New South Wales.
What?
Yeah. And
leading the charge.
Who would have thought, Nathan? New South Wales.
I know. Usually it's Victoria. Victoria's usually the most progressive at the end of the day.
Yeah, Nathan. Yeah, so,
but what you do is you lift them up, George. You lift them up and then you bring them down with a thud, because they might have been the first, but they haven't done it necessarily the best.
Best. Aha. Yes. Good question.
Yeah. So they actually kind of divorced the microchipping from the registration rather than tying the two together. And so it was a bit of a nightmare. And certainly I was also a vet in New South Wales, just by 50 metres. But we also had the issue that we couldn't access the register in those days. So, the only way we could get data from the register, from their register, the state register, was through the council. And sometimes on public holidays, that was a real challenge.
Yeah. And Doug, another thing with New South Wales, they do a bit different. They have registered implanters who are non-veterinarians. Is that correct?
Yeah. There's a number of states now that do that.
Yeah. You can do a TAFE course, as it turns out, and you can actually, become a licensed microchipper.
Yeah, and can you do that in Victoria?
You can. Yeah. They generally, what they require you to have a certain qualification first. So it might be a vet nursing degree or diploma, or any of these sorts of things that are recognised, and then you do a recognised vet implanting course, microchip implanting course, and it's not necessarily, and even the vets have to do a microchip implanting course, but and a lot of vets will say, well, crikey, I can make an injection pretty easily. Why am I doing this? But to be honest, the implanting course is really more to make sure they're familiar with the legislation around it, which is probably the critical thing.
And so you would have been, I guess, like going around and lobbying governments, lobbying, I guess, each of the states to try and get this over the line. So New South Wales was first, and how did it continue from there?
Yeah, so eventually then some of the other states, as soon as that happened, so in New South Wales, for us, just to explain it, we have Central Animal Records, which is a national animal microchip registry, but we also have another company called Microchips Australia, and we have to divorce the two from each other. So Microchips Australia was selling the chips with associated lifetime registries to Central Animal Records, and we still do that. Whereas in New South Wales, that wasn't an issue, because the New South Wales registry was the compulsory registry. So for people in New South Wales, if they wanted to register on a national database, it was only really up to them, basically. So they weren't forced into that. So that didn't really help us very much. But then later on, some of the other states like Victoria and Queensland legislated, and they also had the smarts to then tie the whole thing together with the registry on the national database. So we were then recognised, licensed and audited in both of those states. And it's only really just been in the last short number of years that all of the states now have made microchipping compulsory.
And Doug, is there one database that you can source, or is there two or three or...?
Yeah, so just like the microchipping, back in those days when we were talking about the frequencies and that sort of thing, there were two different microchips, and they were slightly different frequencies, and they couldn't be read by the same reader. So that was a total nightmare, total nightmare. And so we ended up developing a reader. Probably it was infringing international patents, but we developed a reader that could read both, just by switching over. But then eventually the governments decided that we would standardize the frequency. So they brought in an ISO standard, which is a specific frequency. And so therefore we have got multiple different microchip brands being used now, but they all use the same frequency, so they can all be used by the same reader. And then with registries, the same thing happened too. You know, it's a great thing to have a good idea, but once it becomes established, everyone else comes in on it. You know, that's business, I guess. But so now there's 5 or 6 national registries and 2 state registries working. And all of the 5 and 6 registries, we initiated a thing called Pedadress. So, and each of the national registries contribute to that. And the development of that. And so now you can just go to Pedadress and put in the microchip number, and it'll tell you exactly which register it's on. So there's, and those registers talk to each other as far as being able to recover animals. So we can actually look at the different registries and find the details for someone, even if it's not on our register. So that I think we've sorted all that thing out. You know, a lot of people often come up with, there's so many registries, it's so confusing. But it's actually, you know, they're pretty much, you can treat them as one because they communicate quite well.
So that's great. So standardize. I'm glad that you said the government made some sensible decisions. That's a first. So basically now there's a standard in the chip. Can I ask you just a quick question? How many numbers are there in a microchip?
Yeah, so the ISO chip now has 15 numbers in it. And they start with a 9, and the first 3 digits give you a hint as, or not a hint, they tell you which microchip manufacturer it is.
But, got it. Yeah.
And they thought they'd only have to do that for the first 3 numbers, but you know, there was a rash of Chinese and Southeast Asian companies making these chips, and so now, if your microchip starts with 900, then it's the next 3 numbers that will identify who the manufacturer is. So,
tell me about it. So 15, we know that. One of my biggest nightmares in this organisation is the transcriptional errors too, and people entering. You get a lot of zeros in there. You know, when you look at 4 zeros and 5 zeros, you can never tell how many there are.
I know exactly what you mean.
So I feel for all your team at CAR that have to put all these details in. I've got another question. So they're all a standard. Can I ask you, based on what details are in CAR, is that who the owner is of that animal? So if that microchip number is under my name, am I considered to be the legal owner of that animal?
Oh, gosh, George, you have opened a can of worms.
Well, at least I'm just throwing you the ones that I get.
That's what we expect from George.
I'm not
going to like can of worms. You'd be the loose cannon. I said you'd be the loose cannon.
We don't have guests on here just for an easy through. I've got 20 years of pains that I'm going to grill you with there. So that's one of them. I get it a lot. You know, I get a lot.
So, well, you are the listed owner on the National Microchip Registry, yes.
Okay.
In a court of law, that sort of can be questioned as to whether that makes you the legitimate owner or not. In most cases, yes, it would. But in some cases, in some jurisdictions, they look at who has the dog registered by the local council. So there's a difference between the two.
So the reason I bring that up, Doug, is the importance of transfer of ownership. It's usually a nightmare. A lot of people just don't. It's the last thing they do.
Yeah. So, you know, we've you know, you mentioned before the transcription errors and that sort of thing. You know, so since we developed the register, you know, we haven't been sitting on our hands just collecting numbers. We've sort of been constantly developing the software for the register and making a lot of these things, including change of ownerships, more and more user friendly. So a lot of this can be automated. So the microchips have peel off labels, and so that can be scanned in, you know, that sort of thing as well. So, you know, there's a lot of ways of getting around a lot of those errors, and we actually rarely have errors. We've got validation software in the registry. So if it's a Trovan chip, we know that it's a unique chip that's being entered and a valid chip as well. So, you know, all of those things are done in the background, and the change of ownership, as you say, that's a constant issue that people, you know, sell on a dog, but they, you know, it's like selling a car. You know, you have to actually obviously transfer the
have to do the papers.
Mm. But we've made that much more useful. And the main time that can be an issue is when a breeder sells pups to a new owner and they don't transfer the ownership. And so we've got two things to encourage that. One is it's free. So the first change of ownership for any breeder on our registry, I don't think this happens anywhere else.
Free. That's free. You don't check. That's the business model we need to talk about, though.
Yeah. And so all of the registry services that we offer, the recovering or the reunions of dogs, etc., the change of particulars, all that sort of thing, there is no charge on that. You know, once you're registered on Central Animal Records, you don't pay for anything. And the only thing that we charge for is a change of ownership, because that can be quite complex. But for breeders in that early stage, when they sell their first pups, we don't charge a thing for that. And we don't charge animal welfare organisations or the registered animal welfare organisations for it as well. Just trying to encourage that, that thing to happen. And then the other thing that we do, which I think is kind of unique to Central Animal Records, is that we actually send out a reminder every year to anyone that's got an email listed, and that now is the majority of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is, well, we give them a snapshot of the details and say, you know, log in, have a look, make sure it's up to date.
Keep everything
that sort of thing
up to
as
date.
Well.
That's nice. So you send, I'll wait for mine then when I get my yearly. I've just had to re-register Mary, transfer of ownership. So I'm all used to your system, and it was a CR. I've got another.
To make sure we've got your surname spelt correctly, because I know I've misspelt it in the past.
Don't worry, I've kept it at George for you. But I've seen George misspelt to Guruji or Guru, so I'm used to it.
You need a simple surname like Black.
Yeah. Black.
Yeah, that's it. And it's something that I found really interesting when I sort of learnt a bit more about the microchip world was that, you know, being in New South Wales, we don't really think too much about, you know, the national register, because, you know, you have to register it with the state and with the New South Wales Pet Registry. And that's a whole nother conversation about how diabolical that system is. But when we first spoke, Doug, you know, we were talking about a national register and actually the benefits of that, which is that ultimately if you're a breeder, chances are you're selling a dog to someone in another state. And if you just register it, you know, if you're in New South Wales, you just register it with your state. You have no visibility of that when the pup goes to Victoria or to Queensland. So I think that for me was a really interesting sort of point that I never really understood.
Yeah, I think we're certainly... Well, I guess it reflects, you know, the fact that we started this whole system with the sole purpose of reuniting lost pets with owners, whereas I'm probably going to overstep the line here a bit, whereas government registers, maybe that's not necessarily the primary motivation. So it's you know, maintaining a list of animals that are registered in different councils, getting control on that and that sort of thing, with due reason, obviously. But so they're probably not as interested, you know, in an animal that gets out of their jurisdiction. So, you know, someone goes, as you said, Nathan, if they sell pups across the border, which most people do, you know, they're not interested in that. That doesn't worry them. And but we do. We're definitely interested in that. And, you know, people that holiday in different states, they take their animals with them. You know, if that dog gets lost or cat gets lost in Queensland, it's taken into a Queensland vet. Queensland vet hasn't got access to the New South Wales register. So essentially it's blind and it won't be picked up. So, but whereas if it's on a national register, it'll be picked up no matter where you go in Australia. So that's important. And even more important, you know, if you live where I live, you know, on a border, then, you know, it's a necessity. I might be in New South Wales, but I really need to be registering my animals on a national register. They can swim across the river, you know, that I'm looking at now and be on the other side and again, not be picked up. So, yeah, very important.
Yeah, it's got to be a national communication. It doesn't work if it breaks down over state borders. It's ridiculous. People just need to, you know, get over their issues and work together. It's not going to work if it doesn't. Another curveball for you, Doug, and I'm asking you that, have you ever found two different dogs in your system with the same microchip number?
No.
Okay, good. So no one's registered a dog twice with the same microchip number. Good, excellent. Have you ever found or had one dog listed with the same dog with two different microchip numbers?
Oh, absolutely. So we list both numbers. So, and often that's because of a failed chip. Yep. Now, failed chips in, you know, again, you know, you get what you pay for it, like in life. But if you're buying cheap chips, and particularly the more recent chips, you know, then the failure rate is a lot higher. You know, a failure rate in a Trovan chip is, or any European chip, is pretty unusual. Very, very, well, no, I say pretty unusual, it's extremely rare. Also, there can be issues, you know, that happen where someone hasn't adequately scanned an animal before chipping it, or they're using a reader that for some reason isn't working well or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, this dog hasn't got a chip, or this cat hasn't got a chip. And so we'll throw another chip in, and then later on, you know, we find that it's scanned by another vet and they picked up the old chip. So it's critical that, you know, if someone re-chips an animal, they must register the chip and record the old chip number, and we carry.
You see,
they're visible.
Yeah, and I bring it up because it's happened to me. You're experiencing. Someone brings you a dog, and you got your scanner out, and they're going here, and you're trying to scan it. You can't find this so-called chip that's been implanted, and you're searching and searching. You pull out another scanner, and you can't find it. So in those cases, I literally have to say, you know, chip cannot be scanned and verified, and they've provided me details. I've even had people that bring me their dog and go, the chip's here, scan here, and I don't fall for that trick, because I know that some cases people have implanted two microchips, and I'm putting it out there because this is controversial, because under one chip, one animal is registered under a particular name, and under another chip, an animal is registered under another name to allow me to breed more than what I'm allowed to. So I always scan completely, even if they tell me it's there. And I try and pick up if there's two. We also have a system in ours too, which interrogates our database just like yours does. And if we find the same DNA profile to different microchip numbers, it tells us, Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all part of the integrity. You know, the chip is unique for you guys, for us, for everything. So we have... And I know they move around, don't they? They can move around. A microchip that's implanted usually around the shoulder area can move around. Is that right? It does happen?
Yeah, it does. It can happen. And the sort of work that we've done, we pretty much tie that. It virtually never happens in an adult if a dog's been chipped as an adult. But if it's been chipped as a pup, then it can. And what we've found, I think, is that we really need to be pretty precise about where we're chipping the dog. So if it gets chipped too far forward, or if it gets chipped too far back from between the shoulder blades, then we know that they will migrate in known paths. So really, you know, it sounds pretty mundane, you know, being very precise about where you chip, but sometimes we get a bit blasé when we're chipping lots of animals, you know, chip. You know, the important thing is every time you're about to implant, you really check the landmarks and make sure that you're precisely, or as precisely as you can in some of these really young pups, chip in the correct site, and that'll minimize the migration. So,
and I did learn a lot when I used to go to the chipping days, that vets would implant and then tell the client, you know, just make sure, you know, if you've implanted a chip and you've got sort of a real working dog too, it can move around more. So you know, if your dog sort of keeps still for a week or so and not move around, then it's going to allow the chip to sort of stay in that area. But if you let your dog run around and play around in that initial period, it's going to migrate somewhere else. So I've seen them, you know, some people are surprised, but I think working dogs migrate more, if I'm right, because they're moving around more.
I think probably the most important thing there is that often with that activity in that very first sort of stage, sometimes the chip can be forced back out the migration hole. Mm-hmm. So back out the implantation site. So yep. Rather than migration being an issue in that early stage, it's actually the chip coming back out. And so it is important, you know, like it's worth actually even going to the next time you're at the vets, make sure they scan that again.
Check if they're implanted correctly. Mm-hmm.
A lot of animals we've come across that, you know, they might, 3 or 4 years later, they've ended up at a vet clinic and they've scanned it and they said, oh, well, you know, chip's not working. So they'll come to us and, you know, if they x-ray it, most of the time there is no chip there. It's actually and probably come out in the first couple of days after implanting.
I guess that's a good public service announcement, I guess, for anyone listening is just if the next time you're at the vet, check that it's working because, you know, that it's you'll only check when you need it. And that's hopefully, yeah, not at the time you want to find out that the chip isn't working itself. I'm sure that's, you know, a low occurrence, but, you know, definitely worth checking in with your vet.
Great advice, Nathan. And that's the first piece of the puzzle. But the second and equally most important thing is that the chip's useless if your details aren't up to date. So, you know, just reminding people that they can get their own login and adjust all their details by changing their ownership on the register. So, you know, make sure your details are up to date. There's nothing more frustrating than being in vet practice and scanning an animal and, oh, here's a microchip, you beauty. You know, normally you would actually be in contact with the owner, you know, within a minute or 2 minutes after you phone the detail on the record. But nothing more frustrating when finding this number is disconnected or, you know, they've moved address or whatever. So absolutely critical to keep the details up to date.
We often underestimate the value of identification. You know, like I think even, you know, George, what you were talking about before about how, you know, God forbid the situation where breeders would have two microchips in the same dog. You know, I think it's something at Right Paw that we try and do as well. Whenever there's a, you know, a new litter that a breeder wants to share with their wait list and applicants that are interested, they have to put in the microchip of the mum and the dam and the microchip of the sire, the dad. And that is for us, you know, a way as Right Paw that we can check, you know, well, when was the last time that this mum had been bred from? You know, when was the last time that, you know, she'd had a litter? And it's sort of our way that we can, you know, check that breeding limits are being adhered to, ages are being adhered to. And that's because of that identification. So it has so many purposes and uses, I guess, you know, across the breeding world.
It's certainly being in practice, it's, you know, from that early conceptual phase, you know, in the 80s and then being in practice and seeing the system work so well.
Oh, it's great.
It's just so reassuring. You know, you have an injured animal in there and, you know, you're quite anxious. Oh, gosh, you know, who's the owner, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, just to be able to contact and speak to the owner and the owner come down and, you know, be with their animal and give us advice as to what we can and can't do with the dog. It's just such a brilliant thing.
Now, Doug, as Nathan knows, I talked to my son about guests we're going to have on the podcast, and being a 17-year-old, he asked me all these stupid questions he wants me to ask the purse, which are really interesting. I don't think they're stupid. I think they're interesting. They're real practical. So he wanted me to ask Doug, what is the weirdest thing you've microchipped? And it doesn't have to, it can be not an animal. What, you know, in all what you've done, what is the weirdest request you've had to microchip?
I'm hoping you haven't microchipped your children at some point to track them when they're out and about.
Well, the reason my son mentioned this because in 1998 there was Captain Cyborg, a human who has microchipped himself, and don't forget the Swedish have also microchipped something like 4,000 people to record their contact details. So, of course, that's the way the young mind thinks. So he said, "Ask Doug, what is
we have got a couple of bits." Registered on the registry that have chipped themselves. So I don't know whether that's the weirdest thing. I'm probably slating the veterinary profession, but I've implanted chips into shrimp.
Shrimp, okay.
Yeah, so that's probably a bit out there, but lots of different species. But we've also put microchips into all sorts of other different things as well, like, you know, garbage bins and
That's what he wanted me to, garbage bins. That's what he was trying to get me, non-animal garbage bins, people yeah, stealing garbage bins.
Guitars, paintings.
Okay. Yeah, I can see the practicality of it. If someone try a guitar.
Yeah, there's unique guitars, you know, that are worth lots of money or whatever. You know, even safety equipment, you know, that sort of thing for auditing purposes. We've got different chips that obviously, you know, are different to the animal chips. But, identifying anything is critical to any quality program, including...
And is that in your central animal records database, those guitars, and or have you got a separate database for non-animal?
That's Oh, I've just found my lost guitar. That's a separate database, George. Yes.
You know what you're going to make me do now? Every time I go and buy something, I'm going to scan it with the Trove and read it and make sure it's not chipped.
If only.
If only, yeah, I know.
Next time I see you, I'll have a needle. Just bend over.
That's it.
I mean, is that where we're going with the future of microchipping? Like, I know that one of the common misconceptions that Dr. Imogen from our team, she mentioned, is that a lot of owners think that you can track your animal with GPS, and that's what the function of a microchip is. But, you know, where are we going with microchipping, I guess, in the future?
Yes, well, God bless Hollywood, you know, because Tom Cruise can be microchipped and then immediately be tracked from anywhere and at any time, which is just ludicrous. You know, these chips don't even have a battery in there. They're energized by the reader. So to have something small enough that you can stick in a needle and have it tracked from a satellite is just impossible. So that question gets asked to pretty much every week. And we ended up actually... in Microchips Australia, we actually have...
you have a little GPS system.
Yeah, we're distributors of the Petrec 3G GPS tracker. And for that reason, it's just really... and, there, you know, the microchip system is fantastic, but the one flaw is that it does rely on the animal being brought to somewhere where it can be scanned. So if they're lost in the meantime, they can get up to all sorts of strife
trouble.
Or get injured. So if you can be alerted that your dog's out, you know, within a short time of getting out of your yard and you can track it on your phone, then you can avoid a lot of those issues. So
the beauty of them, Doug, is they last for life. They don't need any battery or any power. You know, when you look at all these other great little fancy things, they need some source of power or you know, signal to work from. You know, a microchip does not. The question that I have is, I get this quite a bit, and I used to get it, this RFID. What is an RFID as compared to a microchip?
Same thing. So RFID is an acronym or initials for radio frequency identification devices. And so, you know, a microchip is an RFID device. Basically, it's using a radio frequency to identify an animal.
So the ability to store more information is something that varies according to the microchip you implant. Is that how I read it?
There are chips that you can store information, but the issue with that is then you have to reprogram them to update that information. So some people initially, you know, going back to Nathan's questions, you know, where's it heading? You know, microchips could do a lot more, but if they store extra information, you know, the critical thing then is to be able to update those details. Okay. So say, for instance, you wanted to put your name and address in there or your contact details and you change them, it's a big, big deal then to actually change it rather than just log onto a register and change it that way. So we think, you know, just a simple chip with a code and then linking the code to the data is the way to go. But there certainly are trends into microchipping now that, you know, there is a chip out there that measures body temperature. You know, there's all sorts of different issues with that, you know, depending on where it is and, you know, the size of the animal and all that. So it's not necessarily totally accurate all the time, but that's one thing. And they're working on chips that can measure glucose, for instance, so for diabetic animals and that sort of thing, that could be another
nice another
thing. So there are different trends that are happening. The one, just I'm going to tread into the world of George here and introduce a bit of a controversial thing, but you know, you hear these conspiracy theories about the COVID vaccination, and saying that, you know, they've got a microchip in them, mm-hmm. and you'll be tracking it. You know, have you seen the size of that needle? Like, if we could do that, man, I'd be a billionaire. That needle is tiny. Tony, no way.
And Doug, let me tell you something. You know, your phone, they can track you from that. So when people, all these conspiracy going, you know, if you're using a phone that has, you know, means to track you, tracks what you buy, what you enter, what you look on, you know, it's happening anyway. So they're kidding themselves if they think it's all happening because of some COVID conspiracy.
I guess, you know, Doug, we've got a lot of breeders and owners that listen to the podcast as well, you know, what are the key things that you'd like them to know about microchips? You know, if you could, you know, send out a public service announcement to all of our owners and all of our breeders, what would you like them to know about microchips?
Well, I think one of the things that I mentioned is, you know, like I think a lot of breeders, we're in a frustrating situation with when we actually kind of merchandise the whole market, the product to the vets, but the vets aren't the end user in all the things. The vets certainly are very concerned about, you know, the ease of using their register and how accessible it is, you know, that it's got to be accessible 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, how easy it is to enter the data and that type of thing as well. You know, all those are important issues, but the bottom line is that the end user who's going to be benefiting from that microchip is actually the pet owner and the pet itself, and we're not actually marketing to them, so they don't get much of a choice in the whole process, which is a little frustrating. But what we're trying to do is make sure that all of those people are satisfied with what we can deliver. So for breeders and pet owners, as I say, or I think I mentioned that the fact that, you know, all of the services are free bar the change of ownership. And for the breeders, the first one is free. So that's a critical thing for the breeders. I think being able to log in yourself and change all your details as need or update them and that sort of thing. You can even now initiate a change of ownership on your phone. So we've got all sorts of things that we've done there. We also, you know, in entering litters, we've gone to great lengths to make that really easy for people that are implanting the chips and entering the data as well. So the litters will be entered really quickly and really easily and accurately and that type of thing as well. We're also now, we've reached a stage in life, a bit like George, you know, where we sort of start to, you know, dwell on a few things and, you know, what are we doing for others and for the planet and that sort of thing as well. So we've got a sustainable or more sustainable product as well,
nice.
Where, you know, you don't have to throw the whole device away, you only throw the needle away. So that's one thing. And we also now are donating back into animal welfare. So we, for every Trovan car subscription that we make, we donate to a number of animal welfare organisations on a yearly basis. And Microchips Australia donates into donates gear, readers, chips into various wildlife research projects, and money to Zoos Victoria, for instance, as well. And we support sort of some humanitarian projects like Pets in the Park that offer free services for homeless people and their pets, and so we donate all our chips and subscriptions to them as well. So lots of things, lots of reasons why, you know, we're kind of treating your pet, you know, really as not just a number. You know, we really do care about the whole process and the pets and the owners themselves. So
Doug, my last question, which, you know, again, is curveball. Will we ever be able to read a microchip using my phone? So instead of having to have a scanner, I just pick up a phone and I can just zoom it over. Will we ever get to that stage? And it reads that for me. And
oh, we can do that now.
Can we? What? Yeah, future is here. I've just ordered 10 microchip scanners. So what are you talking about? Tell me, how do you do that?
Well, I say we can do that now. You need an we have an external module that you can piggyback onto your phone, basically.
What?
Yeah. So
can you send me the details when this is all over, please?
Look, you've just let the cat out of the bag because it's not commercially available. So
what? Okay. Yeah. So Doug, this is what I miss.
You're always cutting edge, George.
We used to always have good banter at conferences. That's where I used to meet you at. And unfortunately, with COVID, we haven't been able to spend any of our money or invest any of our money on these conferences. So this has given me a good chat because I would always say, so there's a device coming out. Don't tell anyone, right, that can hook up to your phone and read a scan and scan a chip and read it?
Yeah, so it's just like an add-on module, but they're not commercially available. I mean, it's kind of like just plugging in a reading device to your phone. The reason that we haven't commercially released those is because they've got to actually talk to your phone. Mm. And thanks to, Apple and Samsung and every other phone manager, they bring out a new one every year. So
constantly updating.
Change your device each time. So we're not quite there as far as having that as a commercial device, a commercial problem.
It's another question. When you find a dog and it's lost, you've got to take it to a vet and you've got to find, is there ever a way where you can just, it would be great if I found a dog, I could scan it, find it, and contact the owner. Why is that always? What does it have to go through this process if it needs to go to another person? Why can't I contact the owner?
Because we don't know who you are, George.
Okay, good question. Privacy. Okay, fair privacy. So okay,
you don't want your details visible to every man and dog in the street, so to speak. You want to make sure that they're private and they're only accessible by authorized people. So that's the issue. But, having said that, we also have smart tags now that you can scan with your phone and got a QR code.
Code, yeah.
And what we do with those is we've automated that whole process through the phone, through SMS. And what it does is it alerts the owner and you give permission, the person that.
Yeah.
So if George has found a dog, he scans the tag. Then the owner's contacted and you allow that details.
So the owner would then ring you.
So I think George, it's probably about time for your favorite segment.
Oh, Nathan, yes. Now Doug, this is segment that where we make our guest be the star. So what we do is I have this book where it goes through 200 diseases. It's a quick reference guide for veterinarians written by Dr. Nettie Maddy, fantastic person. And I let you choose a number between 1 to 200. And then I open up the book to that page and I talk about that disease.
126.
Whoa. Nathan, we haven't had it.
We haven't had that. But Doug, that was a very clear, decisive decision. Is that a number in your head for some reason?
No, George was talking that long. I had plenty of time to think.
it's how many million he's made in the industry.
Now, far from it.
Now, you've chosen a disease that is only seen in the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. It's called primary secretory otitis media. So it's interesting. No genetic test for this. Screening is currently not available, it's present until clinical signs are evident. It's an ear disease predominantly seen in the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, although the genetic influence is not known. It's a buildup of mucus in the inner ear, causing pain associated with the head and neck. Signs include scratching around the area behind the ears, pain on moving around the head and attacks, a bit of a wobbly gait. Jeez, it's interesting, all these wobbly gaits and attacks, they're so diff. The symptoms could be so many different other diseases.
Welcome to the world of veterinary science.
Yes, that's exactly. Welcome to my challenge trying to get a control for a disease. It's this condition can also be an important rule out for syringomyelia, which is seen in the Cavalier. Yes. A scratching around the head and neck. Diagnosis is done through mucus and it's done through a CT scan or MRI.
Crikey.
And by surgery to open up the area to examine it. So it's made it in our top 100 diseases. So it's of relevance. And again, Doug, and like most other guests, they've chosen one. It wasn't that challenging. Usually I find trying to describe these diseases based on their Latin or Greek terminology a challenge. You know, I get my it twisted around, but yes, that's page 126 is primary secretory otitis media, found predominantly in the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
Oh, the Cavaliers are such a beautiful breed and they have so many health problems along the way as well, poor things.
Used to be a breed that I'd recommend to numbers of particularly elderly clients, you know, but they do have their share of health issues.
Lovely temperament, you know, gentle breed, nothing, you know.
Great family dog.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, Doug and Nathan, I think it's come sort of to an end, hasn't it, the podcast?
Yeah, I think it's been great. And I think, you know, Doug, anyone who's lost a pet at some stage in their lives owes you a debt of gratitude for having found it through microchips.
Oh, thanks, fellas. Well, actually, the three fellas, two that are retired, they've gone to pastures. But
As I said, I will shout out to Rick. He has been, you know, he sort of fathered me on my initial journey. He was the one that sort of helped me out, reassured me that was all going to work out, George. He would attend a lot of these things for me. It has been fantastic, and the relationship I've had with microchips and CRA, and I'm glad, Doug, you're still around. I know Rick had a pub and retired, but he always bugged me to get that signature for the pit bull. That was his one thing, the dangerous dog, you know, restricted breed. When you see him, shout out to him. We need to catch up again.
And, Doug, if any of our listeners want to learn more about CAR, where can they go?
So the website, and we're very lucky that we cornered, because it was so long ago, we cornered that three-letter website. So
that's
just
like a gold.
car.com.au.
Oh, yeah. Nathan, could you know, if it was me and you, we'd be selling that website. That URL would have been sold to some car. Nathan, can you?
Car sales in the future.
Yeah. Oh, look what you're missing out on.
Oh, yeah. But can you imagine, you know, what we'd have to go through to change that website?
It'd be a nightmare. No, it's got a higher purpose with car, Central Animal Records. No.
But, George, if we, you know, and Nathan, if you, you know, if we're thinking about a new business, like, into selling cars, we've got a website for you.
That's your car.com.au.
You're on. No.
Car.com.au. That's it.
Love it. No, as Nathan said, great to have you on. I've learnt a bit. It's always an area that literally every dog you see has a microchip in it. It's an important little piece of rice grain that we all sort of underestimate. Mm. It lasts for life. It's allowed people to reunite with their lost pets for years and years and will continue to. So well done, guys.
And thanks. Absolute pleasure and privilege to be on the podcast. And I wish you all the best with the podcast in the future. Hope it goes really well, because you deserve it, you guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Doug. And thanks, George. Catch you guys next week.